The Isle of the Serpent, a three-part recording, part three, 31 minutes.
Well, the repetition, you walk around the walls of Jericho, which were impenetrable, seven times, then you shout in unison, just this repetition.
So you're bringing extraneous things, just stay with the image. What is the serpent insisting upon? He's insisting, you tell your story, and then I'll tell my story. Mm-hmm. I'm going to listen to your story, I'm going to think about it, and then I'm going to tell my story. I'm going to meet you with another story, which is like yours.
So if you don't tell me yours, I will kill you.
Yeah, but you must do this. What is the serpent insisting upon?
Becoming conscious.
No, you be precise.
Can I, my reaction to the serpent?
No.
To me, the serpent is extremely intelligent. It's cosmic intelligence. Sort of like the intelligence of the universe.
Yeah, but I want you to answer the question. What's the serpent demanding?
Tell me your story.
Tell me your story.
And when you tell your story, you explain who you are.
No.
You're giving me something by telling me your story of your origins, of your place.
And
in that, expose it to me who you are.
No. You see, in that, I'm asking you, try to stay with the image. The image is, you tell me your story, and I'll tell you my story.
But he doesn't say there's a bargain.
But that's what happens. This is a dialogue. This is totally a dialogue.
They're sharing the pain.
What's that?
Sharing the pain.
They're stories.
I want to get familiar.
It's a dialogue. What's being insisted about? First of all, we have storytelling. Then we're going one step further. We have a dialogue.
Between the conscious and unconscious.
Yes, a dialogue between conscious and unconscious. And the serpent is insisting that you have to participate. You can't just listen to the unconscious. You have to tell your story. And that's why I put in that reference to Pretty Maid of Bronco. Mm-hmm. The devil kept saying, tell me what you saw. But a Bronco kept insisting on telling the story her way. A Bronco wouldn't give the devil exactly what the devil was asking. A Bronco gave her story. Not the true story. Actually, the story she told was false. But it was her story. So that Ivanka held on to her power by telling the story her way and leaving out some crucial details, which saved her life, because if she had told all the crucial details, she would have been destroyed by the devil. In this case, the serpent insists, tell me your story, and then I'll tell you my story, and our two stories will be, and my story will be unexpected, and we will synthesize together a totally unexpected creative synthesis. You know, what's going to happen when we start telling each comparing our stories is going to be totally unexpected, because nobody was expecting the serpent story, right? It seems to come like magic, but if you study it, you see it's a similar story.
And the guide here wouldn't be known so much as Buber.
Nobody's mentioning this is before Buddha and before Jung. This is ancient Egypt. The whole thing is happening in ancient Egypt, and they're making a point. It's okay, but we just don't have enough time. So in view of what we think this thing is about, what is the point of the dialogue? I mean, maybe I've already said it.
Point of the dialogue between the snake and the person.
Yeah,
is to find a common
mutual understanding.
Or a place where they meet.
Well, I would say even more, it's that the encounter with the unconscious is inexhaustible. There's no end to it. There's no single simple truth to be had. It's not about just facts. It's inexhaustible. What leads to a deepening and enriching of life is the establishing of a dialogue. In other words, you listen to your dreams, and you interpret them as best you can, and then you listen to the next dream, that the unconscious gets to talk again, and you listen to that and interpret it again as best you can using your conscious understanding. The unconscious tells you a story, that's the dream, tell a story, that's your interpretation. Neither one is true, they're just different ways of looking at it. And it is through that dialogue that consciousness is enriched. This is all in this ancient Egyptian story. The dialogue is the key.
In my written analysis of this story, I make the point, which I didn't get to make in this discussion, that I think that ultimately that this ancient Egyptian story is about creativity, and that in describing the dialogue between conscious and unconscious, what the story is really explaining is what is the creative process and the riches that the sailor brings back in the end to his farer are the riches that the creative process brings to the established conscious order when the creative process is able to work freely. But that's, as I say, I developed that idea more in my written analysis.
How sure are you that we're not super? I mean, it's a very interesting class, but how sure are you we're not superimposing the Jungian lens on something perhaps the Egyptians really didn't mean?
It's the repetition. Most of all, the repetition.
I don't know. I just am asking. Is the objective a synthesis, or is the objective just the dialogue?
Well, out of the dialogue comes evolution. There is an assimilation and a synthesis, but it's never complete. It's just an ongoing. You never stop dreaming. You may be 90 years old and very wise. You're still going to have a dream the next night that will tell you something you never thought of. It never stops.
Mm-hmm. It's just the way storytelling, you know, like Grimm's fairy tales that you can tell in at different times throughout history.
Yes.
And they resonate with contemporary events.
Yes.
And it's the same story, but the meaning is adjusted to a situation. And it just strikes me as like that seems to be part of the point.
Yes, I agree. Yeah, it's like there are constants that have been repeated throughout the millennia, and the stories are repeated. This kind of story has been told many times. But there's always more and more meaning to be found as you relate it to your story.
Mm-hmm.
See, when you as an individual human being tell your story, which is personal and unique, and relate to this universal and personal story, then something new emerges. So then, if you look at to pursue, I would try. In my interpretation, I do try in my interpretation to provide evidence in the repetition again and again of this idea to try to address your point. When you compare the two stories, the sailor's story and the snake story, they are similar in the sense that both the sailor and the snake have to make a great sacrifice in order to arrive at this land. The sailor loses all his other fellow sailors. The serpent loses all his kinsmen. They both arrive at the land of Punt, having made huge sacrifice. But how is the sacrifice imposed, and what is the difference between the two stories in that regard?
Well, with the serpents divine, where with the attendants by volition.
Well, not exactly by volition.
I mean, he consciously wills the voyage from the sea.
He doesn't will the storm.
No, he goes to a place where the storm is. He understands if you sail beyond a certain perimeter, you're going to be faced with danger. So he's like a soldier going to battle. The soldier knows bolts are going to be flying, but he has to use his will to enter the battlefield.
Right, but then he's like a soldier going to battle who's struck by lightning because he's wiped out by a storm, an act of God. Right, but the serpent is wiped out by a falling star.
Mm-hmm.
So what's the difference between a storm and a falling star?
I don't actually know.
Both are destructive.
Both are destructive. But,
yeah. Well, one is cosmic in nature, right? One is something from outer
physical,
space.
Right.
The other is human scale, more human scale,
mm-hmm.
more familiar. So you see, the sailor's story consists of human-scale familiar phenomena. You know, the ship sinks, he gets washed up on the beach. That's the kind of thing that happens to sailors. The serpent story is much more cosmic in nature. He's a cosmic beast, and his family is murdered, is killed by falling stars. So it's a much more celestial story. So what's the point here? Remember the dialogue. What's the point here of the difference?
Here says something I think is valuable. How glad is who relates, how glad is who relates what he has experienced when painful things are past.
Yeah.
Both stories are past, and both are succeeded in a way.
And both are painful.
So here we have the transformation of experience by storytelling. You may have been through a tragedy. If you can make it into a story, you can assimilate it, and the pain is lessened, and it becomes more meaningful, something you can make meaning of. Yeah. But I'm just focusing now on the disparity between the serpent story and the Zebul story.
But there's a correlation or a similarity in the, like in a cosmic level or in a human level?
Yes. Yes. There is a correlation, but there's also a difference.
It's like just widening circles. As you break out of one circle, you go to a more conscious, like from conscious to personal unconscious.
See, I think it's more specific than that. The sailor tells a human scale story in which human scale events happen. He gets wiped out in the storm. And then the serpent tells a god-like story about being wiped out by a falling star. It's a conversation, it's a dialogue, but it's not a dialogue between equal partners. It's a true dialogue between equal partners. It's not like one sailor's talking to another, and it's not like one god talking to another. It's a human talking to a god. It's a true dialogue between fundamentally unequal partners. And that's a very important idea. It is a back and forth. Both sides have to assert their will. Both sides have to insist upon their story. But they are not equal partners. One is a god, one is human. And that's the essential thing which happens in the story. Now, think about what that means. Think about what that means psychologically in terms of our understanding of an encounter with the unconscious.
And we're dealing with our higher soul level, or whatever that connecting is.
Yeah. Yeah,
we're out of the norm of realm.
Yes. Each side has to do its part. Consciousness has to do its part. We have to think and speak and try to understand as best we can with our limited human experience. But we also have to listen to the messages from the other side, which are mysterious and come from sources that we don't understand, celestial sources, so to speak. We can't, if we allow ourselves to be swept up in the unconscious and forget to assert our conscious understanding, then we get inflated and carried away in manic craziness. We go nuts if we just get possessed by the unconscious. We have to insist upon feet on the ground, what's our human reality. But we have to sacrifice some of our authority and listen to the mysterious realm. Otherwise, we're just confined to rational, the profane.
Can you offer any additional sources? We're saying that the celestial cosmic creature, the cosmic intelligence,
yes,
powerful cosmic intelligence, are unconscious.
They come from the unconscious. Yeah.
And the weak fellow on the belly is our sort of small consciousness, in a way.
Yes.
Sitting in this larger sea of the unconscious, which is truly powerful, truly cosmic,
that
wants to speak to us.
Yes.
And we're trying to dialogue.
Yeah.
It's asking for the dialogue.
Yes.
We're resisting it because it has to do it seven times.
Yes.
So that's a Jungian approach.
No, it's in the story.
Well, were we never to have known Carl Gustav, would we say that? I mean, it makes sense to me. I'm here because it makes sense to me. But
I would say that if you look at other mythology, yes, there is again and again this kind of imagery. For example, Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Talking to the serpent. That's an example of a similar idea.
And then 3 days of waiting is the Christian mythology of death and resurrection, and it's also the solstice stations and the equinox, you know, in the summer solstice it stops for 3 days and stands still. So he laid still. There's
okay.
There's universal
okay.
numbers in here too.
Okay. And the burning bush, you know, the confrontation with the burning bush is a bit like this. The idea of a dialogue is there.
This archetype.
It's almost
Abraham going to the mountaintop and getting the tablets.
No, it's, I was going to say, it's almost like riding a horse. Because a horse, you can only ride it if you realize it's much more powerful.
Yes.
So you're not going to wrestle the horse.
Yeah. It's a lovely point, because it's about relationship, isn't it? You have to develop relationship. And what does the... How does the serpent behave? Here's another internal... You were going to say something.
But yeah, because I was... Because the serpent says that after the story, or that he will be back to his home and
yes.
be safe and everything.
Yes.
The difference is that in the story of the serpent, it says that then I died for them. For him, the experience was like, it's like when you think of something big, like, I don't know, I cannot put it in words very easily, but it's like his experience, like it's in another realm. There's nothing more to do after that. But for him, he can go back to his life with the knowledge
yes.
he learned from that.
Yes.
I don't know if it's...
Well, the, in the
it's like thinking about hate, and when you think about what it means, but if you apply that for you, it can have different ways.
Nuances.
Yes.
So there's a different. They're in different realms. The
yes.
the serpent is in an archetypal realm. He doesn't have ordinary life apparently. He
yes.
just goes around being a serpent. But the human being can go back and have a good life.
Yeah.
You know,
and apply his knowledge.
It's a bit like the Christian myth, isn't it? You know, Christ had
yeah.
to die so people could live. You know?
No, he was dead for 3 days.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, with the death and resurrection, the flooding of the Nile and the rising of Cirrus, when they would watch the Nile flood,
yes.
that would then mark, you know, as the dog star came out, it marked that the river would rise and then it would go down after
yes.
3 days.
Yes.
So
yes.
there's iconic imagery that occurs over and over again.
Yeah. I just want to point out one thing. If you look at the serpents, all the things that the serpent says to the sailor after they've exchanged their stories, he's extremely nice to him.
Mm-hmm.
He's extremely reassuring and kind and friendly and sweet to this man. Again and again, I will give you, I will take care of you, it's okay, don't worry, you'll be okay, I'll put you down gently. He's very, very nice. He's being very related. You know, if you want to establish a dialogue with somebody, it's no good shouting at them or scowling at them. You have to be friendly. You have to smile. You have to offer them sweet biscuits and tea and, you know, make them feel safe. And then you'll be able to have a relationship. So here's internal evidence for what I'm saying, that the story is about relationship. It's about dialogue between unequal partners. Obviously, the more dangerous and more awe-inspiring, powerful partner in this dialogue has to be reassuring and understanding. Otherwise the sailor will be so frightened he won't even be able to open his mouth. So you see that the serpent is being very related again and again, like it's repeated like 10 times. So again, here's repetition that says this is about relationship between the conscious and the unconscious.
But it seems unrealistically easy, you know, because I face him, that's not easy, and it's not a gentle conversation. I mean, I don't know. Seems almost too fairy tale-like.
Well, but for the Egyptian of 4,000 years ago, or whatever it was, who's reading this, this must have been a religious experience. That if you do these things, then here's what I will do. Comes out in the Old Testament also. If you observe these things, then you will have this and this and this. So it's a religious feeling.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You know, the first of all, the sailor loses everything except his himself. All his friends and his ship, everything is wiped out. So it's not that easy. He's lost everything. And
I mean, he's willing to lose everything, like a mystic or a monk.
Yeah, he didn't. It was all taken from him. Yeah, he's and he winds up simply living off the land, the grapes and so on. So he's completely been reduced to a natural state. And then he speaks to the servant on his belly. So he has a very humble and reverent attitude. So he really has the right attitude. He's lost all his ego arrogance, and he speaks on his belly. So he's really been subjugated. And then it's easy. He really has the right attitude. What's perhaps unrealistic, because it's not really attempting to be realistic in real time. It is a fairy story. It's showing things in essence. It happens. His transformation happens quickly. But it's also possible maybe the ancient Egyptians were not so ego-bound as us. Maybe they were a little closer to the unconscious. And, you know, maybe it was easier for them to give up their ego position. Because after all, they hadn't had another, 2 or 3 millennia to build up confidence. You know, they hadn't been through the Enlightenment. They hadn't become convinced that rationality was everything. You know, they hadn't been through the Industrial Revolution. You know, they hadn't conquered the forests. And
it'd be interesting to know where this hieroglyphic were. Presumably, it was some sort of public place where the citizens could see it.
I'm not sure.
Somebody asked about the life expectancy at the time when this story was written.
I would guess maybe 30s or 40s. I wouldn't think. I'm guessing. Maybe 30s. Mm-hmm. Your life is probably a lot quicker. Yeah. And also, it's so easy for this guy. What about his return?
He transcended. He was given 200 slaves. He was rewarded.
Promotion.
Jung talks about the return as being the most dangerous part of the journey. You know, you can voyage into the unconscious and acquire all of this marvelous understanding, but good luck in bringing it back to your friends and fellow citizens and explaining it to them and having them accept it.
Right.
You know, it ain't going to be easy.
Yeah, you know, in Plato's cave allegory, when he returns to the cave, the slaves are chained to the wall and kind of make fun of him.
Right. You know? So what do you think, what would you make of the fact that his return is so easy? He comes back and the pharaoh says, oh, you did great here. You can have all these slaves and I'll make you a count or whatever, make you an aristocrat.
He brought what was expected to happen, to that learning experience probably, you know, in Egyptians. I guess this was a commercial expedition. He brought a lot of stuff. In the subconscious level, probably he had the learning from this relationship with the subconscious.
Yeah, but doesn't it imply, you know, just in a commercial venture, sure, the nation that received the spices and the goods, the ivory or whatever was brought back, would be receptive because it's commercial materialism. But this has a symbolic dimension. So somehow the pharaoh and the community that he's coming back to is extremely receptive to the symbolic wisdom that he's bringing back. So, see, that's what you know, the hero stories point out, that it's very difficult to bring back this wisdom, and the place you come to probably won't be receptive at all. You know,
so return with glory.
Yeah. So, what do you think? Is there anything we could deduce?
I found myself thinking, well, you know, if it was me returning, I would have kept it to myself. I would have found a big cave. It was, really, I was thinking I would have stuck it in the cave and, you know, all that wealth of mine. He kind of selflessly gave it up. So maybe that's part of it, not keeping whatever knowledge for yourself, but sharing it.
Well, also, you know, in those times, there was no independent being apart from the pharaoh. The pharaoh was the god and ruler of everybody. And people didn't have the concept of individuality very well established. It's not like modern American society where people can aspire to be individuals in a city and have their own opinions and their own values and their own relationship to the everlasting. I mean, here it's the pharaoh is God. And the best you can hope for is that the pharaoh will treat you well. You know, so what you bring back automatically belongs to pharaoh. There is no cave where you could put it and set up housekeeping.
In the bank account.
You know, pharaoh. It isn't even that ambition. And there's another story which I think we'll be looking at, which
deals with that. There's not even that ambition. The only thing you really hope for is to be in good with the Pharaoh. And the Pharaoh is God.
So, see, when you asked that question before, I was thinking about the guy that landed the plane on the Hudson River. And, you know, he was, like, acclaimed for coming, returning from the journey. Kind of, you know, that you got the thank you for coming back in time is what happened to all your, and you're recognized as being a hero for them, forgotten the Pharaoh part.
But that again was at the material level.
The material level.
You know, was when people go, when prophets these days go and have mysterious encounters with the unconscious and come back and try to tell New Yorkers about their wisdom, the wisdom they have read from their encounter with the unconscious, they don't necessarily get published, you know, or read, or respected. They might get locked up, perhaps, but, you know, they're not likely to be taken very seriously. I don't know what that means, but I wonder, is it possible that because the ancient Egyptians lived in a time when their connection to the symbolic realm was much closer and more immediate, and that people lived
and derived from nature, you know, from the sun. And
that's right. And yeah.
Well, and all the stuff that he brought back and gave it to the farm, which I was so like, they are not so easy to find. There is, they have a symbolic meaning, but in their daily life, it's not so easy to find. I don't know, the giraffe tails, and so I think it should be when people saw that they respect, because from they found out somewhere that it's not so easy to go,
yeah.
And if we are talking in the not in the symbolic
yes.
level, it's the same. It's like all the knowledge or all the things that he brought back are
yeah.
not so easy to
yeah.
to find.
That brings me one thought is, hey, where did you find all that?
Uh-huh.
This doesn't exist anymore.
Yeah.
In an island, this doesn't
yeah.
exist anymore.
Right. The seven was very
yeah,
clear.
We can get
about
more
that.
Of that.
Yeah. The seven was very
yeah.
clear. This will be gone.
So that's the subconscious that's under the sea.
He's a bit like James Joyce, you know, who wrote Ulysses, and then it was received to acclaim, I think, if I know my literary history. I don't. I think he was respected very immediately for his literary output. I think that was true of James Joyce. Precisely in that. He was received. I mean, this story, he was received well. Of course, the count was not, so I mean, not everybody gets well received by the fairy. The count expects not to be well received, and as you point out, the count perhaps had not gone through this process in the same way.
And it was interesting at the very beginning when the attendant speaking to him, he says, well, I'm not very talkative, and I know this talking bores him like that. So it's very clear at the very outset that this guy was kind of ego-locked.
Yeah.
He had no chance of listening.
And right at the end of the story, the sailor says, behold, it is good to listen to stories. Or it is good
to listen to people.
Yeah, it's good to listen to people. So there again, there's a plug for the importance of storytelling, of the dialogue.
Well, that's what you said at the very beginning, and that kind of attracted me to your class. It's don't immediately jump to conclusions.
Right.
Well, I forget the wording, but hold back and listen. That's a lesson I need to learn.
Yes.
But also, and it might be too large a subject at the very end, but we had spoken about, yeah, but what happens if we do have true insight into something. You know, how do you measure that? I'm not sure if that's a clear question.
How do you know that it's...
Yeah, because you say hold back until this story comes out, but sometimes you might have an immediate insight into something. So, you know, it's not necessary to hold back.
Well, see, I think it's about process and reverence and patience. If you have that insight, great. It'll be confirmed. You know, if it's accurate, and you go carefully and you look carefully at all the details are meaningful, and you will find that if that insight is true, then the details will support it. But you may find as you go through the process, your insight develops or changes or is transformed.
Right. As compared to me, I need to talk about it immediately. Seriously, and that's not perhaps the wisest.
Well, the trouble with that is you wind up missing things, because if you get too invested in your insight, you may not notice some of the details. You know, in fact, what we tend to do is if we grasp immediately the answer, then we interpret everything in light of that answer. Mm-hmm. So if we move too quickly, we freeze our thinking in a particular interpretation, and then we don't recognize the true nature of those details. We don't give the details a chance to speak to us. So it's the same thing. If you talk too quickly without listening, then you don't give others a chance to speak. And I'm probably guilty of that in insisting upon studying what I have to do.
Probably the serpent is like a psychologist asking, what has brought you here?
Yes.
You just tell the dream.
Yes. Yes.
Bad therapist would insist that you say
where. Yeah, I remember just started to be a counselor. He said he's always afraid to give.
I think you can hear that at this point. This was the end of this first class. We were all beginning to get more comfortable with the discussion, and we're beginning to relax and enjoy ourselves. This is the end of part 3. I hope you enjoyed this discussion, and I hope you will listen to other class discussions on this website. Thank you.